Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today I'm excited to be beside my comfort zone, at least, if not out of it. But very curious about where this conversation will bring us. Welcome to the podcast, Olivia Lassard.
Thank you, Amit. Happy to be here.
It's really a privilege to have you. I saw you again at the Stockholm Impact Week, and then I just re-listened to your conversation with Nate Hagans about sort of the state of the world. And so I'm very excited to hear your frame and lens about it, because it's, to me, it's nice to see those lines that you're drawing being put together. But I will start with the hardest question for today, which is the one that I always start with. And that is, who are you, Olivia Lassard?
Gosh, yes, it is going to be the hardest question. I'm not sure. I'm Olivia. I'm first and foremost a person who's very curious about the world. I think the more I sort of grow in life, the more I'm conscious of the necessity to put my energies in service of something much greater than I am. So I kind of have a view maybe to what is the greater thing than, you know, just little me. And so this question about who are you at times is, I kind of lose sight of it. I think I'm a human trying to, you know, make sure that as a human collective, we go forward and we evolve in a safe planet, as safe as possible for everyone, as just as possible for everyone. I grew up in Europe, and this is a layer of my identity that I care very much about for family reasons. If you listen to my conversation with Nate Hagans, you may have gotten some inklings about it. But I'm also, I've been privileged to work in conflict resolution and international security and international affairs for a long time. So I've learned to also sort of, let's say, confront my European identity with other historical backgrounds. I've worked a lot in the Middle East and in certain parts of Africa. So I'm a learner. I'm curiosity myself and a curiosa, if I may sort of put it this way. And at the moment I'm, you know, if we sort of boil it down to what I do with my daily life, I'm an analyst, I'm a researcher, and I'm a person who implements projects both in the fields of international peace, planetary security, ecology, and security at large, multidimensional security.
That's interesting. Those three, the peace, planetary security, and ecology, I'm not so sure that I've heard them pieced together, but perhaps that's where the field is moving. Or are you, how conventional are you in your field?
Not a lot. Not a lot. I mean, first of all, the notion of peace is changing, right? What is peace in a climate-disrupted world, in an unstable world, is a question that we need to ask. Planetary security is, to a certain extent, a bit of a new concept. It has existed in the past, and it came up, for example, with the Rio Declaration in 1972, looking at the various types of ecological crises, plural, that we face as a human collective. But it's taken on a lot more of a sort of pregnant meaning now that we're heating a lot of planetary boundaries and sort of temperature ceilings and things like this. And the fact that we can talk about it, there are responses, international responses and sort of sector-based responses that are taking us towards a new frontier of how technology should respond to planetary challenges. We can talk at some point today about geoengineering, for example, and the fact that, you know, we're now entering this notion of management of biophysical fluxes, of the relationship between the sun and the earth, for example, which is, it's, you know, it's very new. Like it was always part of how science behaves and how, for example, you know, science helps to look at space, but it never really fundamentally entered the space of security, apart from the space conquest within the Cold War and currently. But we would, you know, as a collective, there was never any question that the sun, for example, would be almost a security aspect that we should manage, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then ecology is essentially, it's a response which counters overtly sort of technological responses to the challenges that we have to face in terms of how we build peace today in the world. Amongst, you know, different countries or different peoples, but also how we build resilience as a collective and with the planet rather than against it. I think these are the various sort of things, the threads that that guide my work, and they can translate into very specific sort of analysis in terms of what is going on within the European Union, where I spend a lot of my time as an analyst, but also what is going on from a sector perspective. What does it mean in terms of innovation to respond to planetary challenges, which are not going to double down or lock us forever into technological responses that we're not able to sustain over time, and which may bring sort of, you know, what we call termination shocks or things like this. And all of these questions are very big. They're much bigger than what international security architectures or sort of institutions have been built to really tackle. So we can sense that we're on the cusp of something. And it's very exciting in some sense, because it begs questions about, well, you know, how do we organize ourselves? Again, you know, like the collectivity, like I know that this word is already very loaded, the collectivity. I bring with it my French sort of background in terms of, how do we all, as humans, sort of tackle a number of different challenges? And how do we do it in a way that is going to respect the various cultures, the various backgrounds, the various histories that tie us together, and that the times have tied us together in very violent ways?
Hmm. There's a lot there. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I'm curious if, taking like a half step back, and you're referencing that to some degree, like how you came into this notion of working with peace or and your passion for Europe as well as a project. I'm curious if you would want to talk a little bit more about that, about sort of your personal path into this, like why you came to these questions and why you find yourself where you are at the moment.
Sure. It's been a long journey, but I can tell you a bit more about a recent anecdote that really sort of interestingly shedded light on a journey that I, you know, that has been gnawing at me from the inside for a long time. I was lucky to have a very long conversation with Kate Raworth not so long ago. Massive superstar. We all know her, or at least, you know, if your listeners don't know her.
If you're a nerd. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, she's such a, you know, gem of a human being, and a brain. It's quite incredible. And at some point, as we were getting to know each other, we were indeed, you know, asking each other about our family histories, and she asked me about mine. And I told her something in a way that was new to me to tell the story. I was like, well, so here's the thing. I grew up in a family, you know, on the side of my father and my mother, both my sort of ancestral branches were impacted by the Second World War in almost antagonistic ways. I was very lucky, for example, to have a maternal grandmother who enrolled in the resistance when she was very, very young. She was about 17, and she became a very strong figure in our family, a very strong matriarch who also sort of represented the strength of belief, the strength of convictions, right, that carried her through very dark times in her life, at the beginning of her life, and also sort of carried her within very strong moments of solidarity and brotherhood and sisterhood as she was in the resistance. And she was a real inspiration to me growing up. I sort of looked at her as a heroine, and I was just completely fascinated by her history. And on the other hand, I had on the side of my father, my paternal grandfather, who was captured during the war, and he went to a concentration camp, the concentration camp called Mauthausen in Austria. And I was telling Kate this story, and I was like, and yeah, and so, you know, my grandfather went to this death camp, and this death camp was also a labor camp. And it was a really important piece of, you know, the sort of Nazi industrial machine. There was a granite quarry over there. And my grandfather worked in the granite quarry. And, you know, we have, he wrote a sort of journal of his time in Mauthausen when he got out of the camp, because he was lucky to survive it. But his experience traumatized him in a way that sort of made him question what humanity is. He was subjected to something which is profoundly inhumane and is a, you know, was sort of, you know, like this inhumanity was taken to another level of industrial capacity and was translated almost in this, right? And then sort of, I mean, you know, the history of the Second World War is complicated enough. There is no sort of, you know, like, I shouldn't make any shortcuts, but there is something very symbolic about the way that industrialization also led to some kind of absolutism in terms of identities, in terms of ideologies, and then sort of led to a conflict which Europe built itself from, but first got destroyed by. And my granddad represented that. He was a person who survived, but who never got to really sort of experience how to transcend this level of inhumanity, because it was too dark. And on top of it, during his time, there were very little sort of psychological tools to help people out of that darkness. But I realized, whilst talking to Kate, that I've built my life in terms of these antagonisms to a certain extent, you know, like this notion of inspiration of what it means to fight for ideals, to fight for a cause, to have a fundamental inspiration coming as a resource, a human resource that stems from the inside, from the heart, from the guts, from, you know, a sense of strength that carries you forward. And at the same time, you know, sort of running against where humanity can go in very, very dark places, and how to sort of avoid going back there and building systems, industrial and political and geopolitical systems that are built on this darkness. And it's been an interesting thing as part of this conversation to realize that, you know, the first part of my career was very much oriented towards how do we build peace? How do we take, for example, inspiration from what happened in the European Union, which was essentially an architecture of peace, built through a vision of reconstruction, of mutual neutralization, of sort of, you know, ideologies that would lead to the worst. And then through my journey, working in different parts of Africa and the Middle East, realizing that parts of this architecture is built on materialism, right? Like how we've built peace in Europe is partly based on industrial projects that got melted, like that got fused together, energy systems that got fused together, and also which became a single market. A single market, which is, you know, like based on fluxes with other regions of the world, which are based also on materialism and consumption of resources. And realizing essentially that we now have or face a really strange, ironic, and difficult dilemma as we enter, you know, this reality of a planet which is in ecological overshoot and which is an economic crisis. Well, in order to move away from that, in order to move from an energy system which, you know, feeds into greenhouse gases and which moves over time to hopefully circular economic systems that are less materially intensive, we actually first have to be extremely materially intensive and extremely extractive. And we have to build an architecture which is going to rely on mines, rely on ecological destruction in some places, on, in some, you know, places, especially where sort of mineral deposits overlap with indigenous territories or massively important cultural territories, there may be sort of, again, you know, this sort of like fundamental dialogue, or not dialogue, but, you know, like very tense situation of the vision of a modern world, a sort of, you know, technologically oriented world, an industrial world against, you know, ancestral knowledges, forms of knowing and forms of living that are different. So it's almost as if, you know, we're coming, it's from a philosophical perspective, we're now at a critical juncture because it's actually really almost metaphysical, philosophical and existential questions that we're facing all at once. It's whether or not the systems that we've built and created are still fit for purpose. And what is purpose? You know, like it's all of these questions. And
yeah,
we can sort of disaggregate that from this very philosophical type of questions to how do we pragmatically ask these questions and answer these questions, and what do they give in terms of policies and industrial behaviors, measurements, and things like this. So I find the times in which we live fascinating, and I find them fascinating because I can emotionally relate to them because of my family history. I can intellectually relate to them in terms of having been interested in history for a long time and knowing also, again, in my bones, in the friendships that have formed across borders and across different cultural identities, that we have to find a way to stick together and ask really tough questions without tearing each other apart at a moment when we're all at stake.
I could really feel the response and emotionally in terms of as you're telling the story of your grandfather's experiences. I've only touched that in my family history, so I don't necessarily have it. But I've been reading a lot especially recently, Viktor Frankl's "Man's Search for Meaning," which is really there. And then also the capability that we have to adapt to the most. To any circumstances, really, literally, I think, as humans, and how we make sure that we are get to stay around, if you will. I don't know how this is going to be a big question, but I kind of trust your expertise on how to bring us into it. But I'm curious about sort of if we, because there's a particular. There's a way to look at the world, I think, or at Europe, maybe. That's, or I don't know how to draw the lines there, really. But that is familiar, I think. I mean, at least it's the way that I was taught in school and so forth. And this is how it works. And what you're talking about in terms of ecological destruction and colonialism, or those aspects are, I think, to most people that live in Europe, at least. Not so well known, at least not the full extent of the basis of our financial and economic wealth, and the sort of how political systems have, and economic particularly, I guess, systems have influenced sort of the state of the world the way that it is right now. But I'm wondering if there is what is sort of the necessary baseline knowledge of like how you see the world as it looks right now. Like, how do you, like, is there a way of inviting people into what you were just alluding to, like this sort of that it's not unproblematic to think about electrification, for instance. It's not unproblematic to think about what are the exclamation points, or what are the question marks that we could put after these things that you cannot say, like, you know, oil bad, electric stuff good, industrial farming always more. I don't know what the sort of the main parts are, but I guess food and energy is pretty fundamental, and then water maybe.
Food, energy, and water, the critical nexus. Yeah. So your question is about how do we have this conversation then?
Or like, if from where you are sitting and in the conversation that you have, what does it look like at the moment? Like, how do you see these things? Like, if you'd go a little bit deeper into the conundrum, or like the pickle, if you will, or like the predicament.
So it's a good question. I think it allows me to maybe take a couple steps back and to almost sort of not analyze the reality of the crises that we're facing, but the relationship to the crises and how different people interpret them. And indeed, I'm going to take Europe as my starting point because it's the place that I know best, right? And because there are some interesting conversations happening. So I think, let me start maybe at the sort of bigger layer. We have conversations that are quite polarized at the moment in Europe, where on the one hand you have indeed people who are looking at the state of the planet, of the natural world, and who are saying we can't go on like this. And they're right. And a lot of efforts, particularly in light of what we know about the climate crisis, have been focused on oil and gas, you know, sort of needing to be stopped, and particularly new exploitations or exploration sort of, you know, permits not being granted, and then sort of, you know, like working towards more, you know, what in French vocabulary we call sobriety, which translates into some kind of sufficiency in English. And therefore sort of, you know, moving over time and quite quickly by now, because we're hitting a lot of ceilings, towards a reduction of materials, right? Of reduction of consumerism and a different relationship to growth, economic growth particularly. Mm-hmm. And the moment when you touch on economic growth, you start touching on very deep held beliefs, which have to do with livelihoods on the one hand, justice, fairness, generation and distribution and redistribution of wealth. And in Europe, you also touch on the sacrosanct welfare states, continental Europe particularly, and the necessity essentially to generate growth in order to generate taxation, in order to build essentially sort of a welfare system which is going to create the basis for solidarity and fairness, however you define it and understand it in the international context. And how you build also, and this is the part that has been missing in the conversation, which is now coming up specifically as a result of the war in Ukraine and other things, how growth helps to generate hard security, how it's actually related to this notion of innovation. And innovation is going to be related to how you compete with other regions in the world, and how you keep a certain comparative advantage, and how you keep a certain edge that is going to allow you to constantly maintain this equilibrium that essentially sort of goes back to this need of creating a national political economy that has coherence, that has, you know, like resilience over time in economic terms and things like this. And in order to generate competitivity and innovation to a certain extent, you don't reduce resources, you actually increase the use of resources. So what is emerging in Europe as a picture, and which is still not quite computed or integrated within discussions at political levels, in sort of civil society and amongst, you know, like different parts of Europe, is that actually we face a dilemma that we've never really faced before, where the notion of planetary security, defined very loosely as a healthy, organic and sustainable equilibrium of human civilizations and the biosphere, is now in direct opposition with how we build international security. Because international security is indeed based on resource extraction and over time innovation that leads towards more consumption of resources, and in order to maintain that, more consumerism. And that dilemma, planetary security against international security, is a complete novelty, a massive dilemma in the way that we, you know, sort of interact with one another. And so I see essentially that, you know, there is a new realization about this emerging in some parts of Europe, but that the conversation is still very polarized and therefore very contrived. The polarization that, you know, is leading to a lot of fragmentation from a political and civic perspective in various parts of Europe is also exploited by those who'd rather see Europe fail as a market, as a political force. And so we are in a very, very fragile moment in Europe, at a moment when, and it's been a sort of reckoning, right? Because if only just even 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when the Green Deal was pronounced as being like the geopolitical roadmap for Europe, there was this sense of enthusiasm that finally one geopolitical force, however strong or weak you define it, right? Like a lot of people would say that Europe is not a geopolitical force. They have some points, but it's still a very important actor in geoeconomics and geopolitics in the world. And it was a first mover saying, no, no, we're tackling greenhouse gases. We're doing it via green growth. This is our political project, our economic project, but we're doing that and we're trailblazing. And then COVID happened, the war in Ukraine happened. Now hyperinflation is also sort of rising as a result of geopolitical disruptions, including, you know, the Armenia-Azerbaijan conflict, the war in Gaza. And all of these are just essentially sort of now structural information within a geopolitical system, which is in disarray and which is in a state of incoherence and systems rivalry. And Europe is not fully equipped, or at least not completely equipped, to deal with that level of multiple crises coming from an ecological source, from a hard defense source, from a geoeconomic source, from a financial one, whilst at the same time trying to deal with its history, right? So if we move past the coal and steel origins, which built the DNA of the European Union, we need to transition away from that, building a different type of industrial and energy architecture that requires political dialogues of a certain kind within Europe. And it requires political dialogues and economic dialogues with other regions that Europe now finds itself dependent upon, which it has exploited in the past, and where there is a huge amount of trauma and collective trauma to sort of, you know, like surface and to deal with in a healthy way, and collective histories to rewrite. And so it's a lot to deal with the future and the past all at once, and to do it in a way that, you know, is trying to work towards justice and peace and working on economic security, energy security, geopolitical security. It's not a surprise if a lot of ruptures are happening on European geographies at the moment. Because Europe historically has terraformed a lot of the world through many different fluxes, including colonial histories, and has used accumulation of resources via colonial means in the past to build its own very ambitious and very fragile peace project. And in its own time, the European Union did trailblaze what peace via mutually reinforcing economic means could yield in terms of benefits of peace, of political stabilization, and of common project. And now it's this as well, which is being questioned from within and from without. I mean, from outside, should I say.
There are two parallel thoughts that just stood out in hearing you speak about this. But one thing was the way that I've read about the First World War and how it came to be, and this sort of the Schlieffen Plan, and like all of these things where there was like a plan for when something happened and certain actors did something, then there was like a reversal back into sort of set plans that weren't fit for the actual environment, but people kind of just had to fulfill them. And like as Russia started to mobilize and so forth, like that's the way that I've studied that part of history. But then, I mean, that was a military mobilization, but I'm almost hearing that there's a similar trend maybe going on in a completely different arena at the moment. Like that there are these conditioned responses for certain things, or even if they are not sort of as much as sort of written out plans, I don't know about that, but maybe they're more sort of conditioned responses because of the training that we've had, or the training of the staff of these institutions have had, that there is a certain way of protecting certain things and maybe not seeing other things, and that might not be fit for the highly interconnected global fragile world or supply chain or however you want to call it that we're living in at the moment. So that was, and then I picked up something that you spoke to Nate about in terms of sort of a positive or a negative piece, and then I was just wondering if it's a correct understanding that it's almost like Europe has a negative piece. It's like it's more almost like a cancellation of other things, like this escalation of, is that the right way to understand it, or is it, am I?
So in very schematic terms, negative and positive peace are understood as different types of equilibriums, right? Negative peace is almost when you have frozen conflicts. And we can see at the moment, when you have a frozen conflict, it's essentially the absence of direct violence. You see at some point that they erupt back. Positive peace by comparison or contrast is, how do you go deep and address the drivers of conflict in the first place and manage to transform them so as to create a different type of political, cultural, economic landscape that allows you to really transform what drives you to war in the first place? And so to a certain extent, and this is going to be a really interesting thing, you know, like, and here we're talking mostly in sort of theoretical terms.
Sure.
But the European Union for a long time now, I mean, like for a long time in terms of our generations and obviously in the history of the world, you know, a microsecond, but still has been the epitome of a positive peace. Mm-hmm. Even just typically the Erasmus project, the Schengen space that allows European nationals to travel across a continent and to sort of learn different languages, to study each other's histories, to relate to each other as Europeans, not French, German, Poles, and, you know, Swedes and all of these different things. This is an extraordinary feat that came out of political discussions that were based on energy in the first place and on industrial sort of, you know, mutual reinforcement. But the interesting thing is now, you know, seeing whether or not, since there is this energy transition, which takes Europe away or calls for Europe to transform its original DNA, its economic, energy, and industrial DNA, we'll see how much of this ability to have created a European cultural space, a European identity space, can withstand really fundamentally, like some really strong winds in terms of geoeconomics, right? It's not a surprise, for example, that in the wake of the war in Ukraine and the difficulties that countries like Italy, Germany, Austria have been experiencing now that, you know, so-called cheap Russian gas has been sort of, you know, neutralized.
Yeah.
And that it raises fundamental questions about different sources of energy between gas and coal and nuclear and hydropower and what it means in terms of industrial projects. It's not a surprise that right now there are some real tensions between France and Germany, right? It doesn't mean that they cannot be navigated, but it shows that whenever, you know, the rubber hits the ground and the road in terms of, you know, sort of denting at these industrial and energy foundations, there are some very real difficulties that are translated in political economic terms from a national perspective. And how to deal with all of these layers of complexity, right? From the sort of local, you know, politics at the end of the day are also, you know, like take root in local dynamics, to then sort of, you know, like the sort of subnational level to the national level to then the inter-European level, and then to sort of like try to coalesce it or alchemize it towards a coherent sort of regional geopolitical response. It's very, very complex. It's very complex. It's very dangerous because at the moment, you're like, the world is made of instability that translates into dangerous stuff, not just inconvenient stuff or difficult stuff. But the part that I want to say is just like, Europe and Europeans know this. And that's where a lot of our strength lies. Complexity built Europe. And to me, I've learned as well, going to a lot of different sort of violently conflict-affected places in the world, complexity raises us as humans. They call on us to evolve in ways that are unknown. And we are in an unknown territory in the history of the world, in the history of human civilizations. So whatever path we decide, and history is made of concurrent paths playing out almost simultaneously, you know, whatever we're headed towards is going to be some kind of evolution. We're called on having a different consciousness in terms of how we relate, in terms of identity, in terms of territories, in terms of natural resources, in terms of habitable places, in terms of security, and how we sort of, you know, design something which is going to be adaptable, agile, nimble. But before we get there, we're going to be almost sort of, I think that there are some very strong reflexes in human consciousness and in the metastructures of international relations. I know it may sound like jargon, but you know, when you experience a crisis yourself on a personal level, you can have sort of, you know, like moments of clarity and moments of alignment, but there are like, it can also play out with like reflexes of how you defend yourself and how you have mechanisms that are very strongly embedded in your body, in your mind, and how you are just trying to ensure your survival space, right? Well, that same level of, you know, like concurrent energies and sort of defense mechanisms can play out also in international relations. And they have a logic of their own to a certain extent, which at times, you know, almost escapes, you know, individual national agency, right? Like the collective creates something of its own. And that's what we're up against at the moment. We are in a juncture of history where we're still in a myth, in a dream of like, oh, you know, we can create economic growth and sort of, you know, create a pie that grows bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah.
We're coming to terms, I think, in places that are very energy intensive and which have relied on material fluxes and material extractions away from where we consume energy. We're coming to sort of a realization that there's a flaw. We don't want to admit it yet, but there is a fundamental flaw in that. the pie cannot grow infinitely bigger when we're facing a planet where there is concurrently very rapid scarcification of resources like water, arable land, biodiversity, health, and habitable places. And that change, that fundamental piece of information, has yet to really trickle into how we understand the future of security and how we understand how to relate to one another. For now, we're entering a bit of a zero-sum game in geopolitics with a race at the bottom. We're going to suffer from it for however many years, but I'm pretty sure that at some point there's going to be a number of other voices that are like, that are going to sort of rise up and say, no, no, but actually, like, if we do this again with zero-sum geopolitics, with competition playing out over what we need in order to survive as a human species, we're not going to make it, neither one of us, right? So we're going to need to find a different way. And that notion, that architecture, what peace in climate-disrupted worlds, futures, and ecologically disrupted futures looks like, we don't yet have the template, the wisdom to grow towards it. We will. It's in the making. It's in, something is rising, I think, in collective consciousness. But how we come to it and what moment we come to it collectively is not yet clear.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I mean, also to what you were saying before in terms of Europe having to deal with its past and its future kind of at the same time. And then, of course, you know, in sort of a world where whatever has been done in history is also there. I mean, it's there as a playbook for, and I mean, if you see India or China or how they move in the world, and especially, and maybe even Russia, I think you were alluding to in the conversation, like in this sort of resource scarce world that there is grabbing, and there is a way of how to grab or how to show up in these places, both, you know, with threats of kinetic violence, but also I think economically, in order to position yourself and to gain or secure access to resources. In terms of threading the needle or like starting to move towards this balance, or do you see any, what are the constructive narratives where we can both sort of stay out of maybe sort of the supranationalist agenda or stay out of the techno-utopian agenda that we just innovate or like just assume naively or whatever, just assume that sort of energy is not going to be a problem? Or do you see any sort of what Google phrases would put you on a generative, on a constructive path? Like if you want to sort of do the reading and starting to get into this in a constructive way, like where would you start looking? Like where do you see the, is it sort of the localization movement or like the permaculture? Or like what, where are the, are there any sort of spots of islands of insanity in a insane world, or are there spots of sanity in this? Or storytelling, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that the storytelling that I find myself really drawn to at the moment is Kate Raworth's work, The Donut Economics, as a vision, right? She doesn't give a template. She has drawn out questions. She's drawn them out in a brilliantly simple visual way. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like, you know, the donut has become an object. And it's an object that allows, I kind of, you know, like picture it as an object that can sort of, you know, like be in the middle of a table where a lot of people sort of come together at whatever level. And, you know, like her deal project has started, her Donut Economics Action Labs, I think it's called, has started to sort of, you know, use the donut as a sort of object, asking a number of different questions to sort of create different analytical lenses, for example, for cities like Amsterdam or Brussels or Portland, I believe. And they bring together different people to talk about how to organize, how to sort of, you know, bring their cities within the donut, which obviously raises questions about cities and their dependencies outside of the cities to rural areas, to international sort of, you know, dependencies, like Amsterdam, for example, started looking in its dependencies, I think, with on cocoa. And therefore, I believe it was Ghana where they import cocoa from, right? And it's a fascinating thing because all of a sudden it's a very simple tool that allows you to sort of look at different measurements and different ideas of, you know, what is production, what is consumption, how is wealth organized, generated, redistributed, how does it help to create social contracts, and how are those social contracts actually dependent locally on very wide webs of interdependencies, and what does it create in terms of co-responsibility, co-solidarity, for example, between, yeah, I don't know, Amsterdam and some cocoa producers in Ghana, for example. And what are the tools to try and enact essentially that level of responsibility, transparency, that level of, you know, like sort of justice, fairness, whatever you want to put into that. But this very simple tool allows to have a different outlook on the reality of where we are at in economics and in socioeconomics. And parts of, you know, the conversations that I've been having with Kate is when we look at all these fluxes of material resources that sort of, you know, like create those pillars of hard security, of soft security, what does it mean in terms of the various equilibrium? So that's, you know, part of the work that I find very exciting, to sort of, you know, like enter into those multidisciplinary conversations, yeah, and start asking questions. For me, what has guided me, what inspires me is to, and this is another friend of mine who I think wrote it very astutely in his book called Designing Regenerative Cultures. His name is Daniel Christian Wahl. He said, let us be guided by the questions, not by the answers. And I find this really incredible. And for me, from an intellectual perspective, it also sort of relates back to, I was lucky at some point to take a bit of a tangent in my career. I took a bit of a break and I went to work on permaculture farms in different parts of the world. So I was very curious indeed about what permaculture was. Like, it was very just at the time, it was really like more than 10 years ago. And I was kind of like, I mean, it's difficult to understand, like, you know, they're talking about agriculture, but then, you know, like permaculture from a political and sociological level, I don't understand, what is it? So I just went to try and understand, right? I went to work on permaculture farms. And to my surprise, something that I just didn't know as a person who had grown up in, you know, a sort of little rural area, very well connected to Paris, is that if you learn to work with nature, you can bring back resources, you can bring back water, you can regenerate land, you can bring back, or you can work on, you know, sort of making the space necessary for complex biological sequencing from a vegetal and an animal perspective. And that was just a complete game changer for me, because I was like, oh, wow, like now we're talking about growing the pie. Now we're talking about sort of repairing a pie that we're damaging and extracting from and at a rate which is endangering us. And it's endangering us in our health, in, you know, the sort of political economies organized around nations, and around international and now planetary security. So when you mix essentially this thing, for me, the formula that I'm now sort of working with, and it's not a formula which is, you know, which gives a sort of like specific template, but it's just, I know that there are certain milestones that we should not forget. We cannot go about the fourth industrial revolution with another wave of hyper-intensive extractive waves. Mm-hmm. Without, for example, going through a regeneration revolution. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, like sort of raises some questions about very strong legal protection for certain ecosystems, change in agricultural productivity. And it just, like, you know, having this in mind allows me to sort of delve into the complexity of the questions that I'm dealing with, which lead me to more and more dilemmas, right? And understanding how to sort of, you know, like almost be shaped, almost be worked from the outside by these dilemmas to sort of be like, okay, I know, I've learned physically that there are some things such as how working with nature can help to rebuild ecological security. Yeah. Some things that I didn't know before, something that I learned at some point, which changed my knowledge matrix. And there are many more things that I don't know and that are going to arise essentially as sort of, you know, not solutions are the way, like, you know, we're not talking about linear solutions. We're talking about pathways. There are many things that will open up, but we need to hold all of these questions, which are very difficult to hold at, you know, it's a very natural reflex, especially in our information society, especially in the sort of mental space that we're being given to experience with social media, with polarization of news and stuff like this. We've become very binary. And again, in order to face everything that we need to face as humans, we need to sort of reclaim that notion of complexity and delve in it. It's almost like going into free diving, right? Like we recover that ability to hold different forces together and to trust that we are able analytically, emotionally, philosophically to just find a way forward. That polarization is sort of, you know, impassioned responses that lead to violence and sort of either or don't really work.
I love how you say that. I think especially this sort of the needing of all of these constraints and things, like letting them actually like form you and take shape, and then trusting that there's a space in the middle that you can actually inhabit, which is generative. And also how you speak about these. I mean, I think I've been looking a lot at Nora Bateson's work in terms of her Worm Data Labs, and kind of, I haven't yet taken the training, but I've been kind of playing with that concept of shifting between contexts and like discovering problems or discovering ourselves or being with questions through different lenses or different contexts. And it's incredible how just having the same conversation around the same question with different people will completely change the answers or the possible sort of notions that come up. And then I think also this whole notion of the bioregionalism, I think that's a very interesting lens because of how it kind of maps out some biophysical dependencies, which would be sort of energy and water and stuff like that, and then to contrast them with the economic dependencies, because they are in a sense, I mean, not unnecessary or non-essential necessarily, but still they're manufactured in a different way. And usually the economic dependencies might be able to look, you know, take shape differently if you have the ability to imagine them differently or something like that. And then also this sort of on a philosophical lens, like this whole notion of the hyperobject that I think Tim Morton brings in. I think it's very, very interesting to start looking at, you know, even the physical objects around us, not as physical objects, but with clear limits, but actually as a result of all of these sort of interactions that has happened through a whole full supply chain, whatever that may mean. And it's a lot to carry, of course, like to try to do that analysis every time. I don't succeed, but every now and then to kind of drop into it. I kind of want to also jump into that because we're in a way we're implicitly speaking a little bit about sort of the potential dangers of this techno-utopian narrative, where we keep talking in terms of solutions and problems, and we keep talking in terms of things that are good and things that are bad, and like these categorizations that we tend to make. And just to bring you back to that initial door that you opened in terms of terraforming or what do you call it? You actually call it geoengineering projects. Is there? It seems like there's a bridge to that here somewhere that I can't articulate intelligently right now.
Yeah, and I think it relates back to this notion of ecology of being that Nora Bateson also works on, right? Or sort of helps us to move through in terms of language, in terms of philosophical space between, for lack of better words, I'm going to say spirit and matter, and how the two interact. So here is the state of play with this notion of geoengineering, let me just start by sort of mentioning what geoengineering is or what it means today. Mm-hmm. There is a realization that we're heading so fast towards 1.5 of sort of global temperatures as opposed compared to pre-industrial levels, and that we may just race by 1.5 and head like overshoot towards much more. You know, like we should refer back to the paper that was published last week and peer reviewed by James Hansen et al. Called Global Warming in the Pipeline, which sort of gives a very sobering look at where we are today in terms of trajectories regarding global warming. There is a concern essentially that if we hit 1.5, you know, we're going to set forward a number of tipping points if they're not already set forward essentially, and that it may just, you know, will shift essentially into a different biospherical, biophysical, biochemical regime. And there is very large uncertainties. In fact, there are many question marks as to what will happen to human civilizations, complex human civilizations. And so one of the strands of research, sort of chapeau research that has emerged out of that realization, and which originally came from the 60s, 70s, actually, in relation to another topic, which was actually about war. Some of the sort of research that have been poured in the last decades has been, one, had to try and sort of do direct carbon capture, which a lot of people now talk about. Another thing is how to maybe temper with weather disruptions, particularly around the change in rainfall patterns, and therefore how to do cloud seeding. Cloud seeding is essentially sort of literally seeding clouds with certain types of chemicals in order to produce and generate rain. In order to do this, however, you need a certain basic level of moisture within the air so that it sort of, you know, almost sort of acts as a catalyst, and then sort of, you know, like you direct essentially rainfall patterns to certain places. And the sort of meta level of what we call geoengineering is, well, how do we actually sort of reduce the intensity of the greenhouse effect on the planet by trying to manage the level of solar radiation that comes onto the Earth? And typically, you know, like some conversations happening in climate science circles at the moment are about how sulfate dioxide, for example, particles which sort of, you know, like coalesce into the air, create almost like a shield, where, you know, like some solar radiation rays sort of, you know, like are reflected back into space and therefore do not contribute quite as intensely to the greenhouse effect. Let me just make a very clear sort of mention here that geoengineering technologies are not about solving climate change. They're really about trying to sort of manage the effects essentially of climate change. So we're not talking about really sort of fundamentally reversing our course back in terms of temperature hike. We're essentially trying to sort of see how we can maybe avoid the most disastrous consequences of global warming. But there you go. But here is the catch. If we start messing around with very fine, subtle, organic equilibriums that the planet, you know, is ruled by and is sort of lives by, we don't know what unintended consequences we may go into, right? So to give the most extreme of examples, and I will direct your audience, for example, to the book, Elizabeth Colbert's book called Under a White Sky. One of the things that she talks about in her last chapter is how if we sort of, you know, do planetary solar radiation management and start tempering with the effects of the sun coming into the Earth, then it may eventually mean that we lock ourselves into fossil dependency, because otherwise, well, energy around, you know, sort of photovoltaics, wind and water will actually be compromised. And so there is something just completely kind of incoherent and absurd almost about going into that direction. But is this catch 22 of, like, if we're still going way past, you know, like hurtling towards that sort of temperature hike, which we cannot let happen on the one hand, But the reality is that we are hurtling towards this, then do we apply some kind of mechanism, even of a technological kind, that will eventually sort of, you know, take us there? And it relates back to this notion of energy transition. And this is essentially like all of these very fine equilibriums that we have to manage, right? I've given you the larger picture around geoengineering. Let me take a step back and come back to what's happening now. What's happening now is there are lots of efforts to try and move towards decarbonized forms of energy, trying to maintain a business as usual sort of, you know, economic model, which means that we need a lot of different types of minerals in order to assemble clean tech. And that clean tech is, you know, sort of needs to replace, for example, fossil use in Europe and China and the US, everywhere, in very energy intensive countries, but also sort of be distributed to energy demand countries, essentially sort of what we used to call developing countries. That's a lot of different minerals, especially for the next 15 years, to extract. And unfortunately, a lot of these minerals are located in very sensitive ecological areas. A lot of people today will say, yeah, but compared to the level of extraction, which happens on a daily basis for fossil fuels, extraction for clean tech is going to be quantitatively less than the history of extraction for fossil fuel. This is true. Like, this is absolutely true, but it's not just how much we're extracting, it's where we're extracting from. We're extracting potentially from places that are the very natural environments that help to sustain, maintain, regulate the global climate regime, which provide a lot of ecological services in terms of health, disaster buffering, distribution of rain, and generation of hydrological systems. And that also, and this is part of the ecological, you know, ecology of being, that go way beyond providing services. We have evolved as a species thanks to nature. We are nature, biologically speaking. But we also draw, and this is something that I find very interesting, we draw a lot of our creativity, our innovation, our inspiration from the natural world. Look back towards poetry, look back at paintings, which, you know, we all sort of can be moved by and inspired by. You will find nature is always there. And if we go about essentially sort of, you know, our energy transition in a way that destroys the very sort of complexity of being from a biological perspective, those ecosystems that inspire us, that move us, that provide for us, that we interact with, that have housed traditional, ancestral, diverse forms of knowledge, of wisdom, of knowing, if we get rid of that, and if we go into a planet and into a future which is mostly based on technology, industrial and mechanical ways of being, which is almost what, you know, like the future of the architects of AI and the metaverse kind of talk about when they talk about transhumanism and sort of getting rid of physicality and getting rid of, it's techno-utopian, but it sort of, it almost removes a very fundamental part of what makes us human. And it brings me back, at least to me, it takes me back to a landscape of what my grandfather went through. Because what is the future that we will create for ourselves if we keep on digging ourselves out of humanity? This is a very, very fundamental question, which brings us back to what are the futures that we are creating for ourselves when what is called techno-utopianism is almost sort of techno-surveillance, is very hard and mechanical and industrial, needs to sort of use technology in order to manage ecology when we know more about the surface of Mars and the moon than we know about the fundamental ways in which our ecology as a planet, as a species functions in terms of interbeing, in terms of ecology. And what, like, I don't know how to make that link yet, but I have in the back of my mind, you know, this threat of, like, I hear the sort of thumping of totalitarianism in some ways, that there is some kind of relationship between a very, very strong held belief in terms of human supremacy and how to organize it via industrial ways and technological ways. And that's not where innovation should take us, because we know from history what it looks like. And we've spent a lot of time trying to undo the damage that it has done. So we're in, you know, again, it's holding all of these different contrasts and realities and different parts of our humanity, right?
Yeah. 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 And I think, I mean, several, but I think in a way it's interesting with the sort of epistemological climate that we have, like who gets to speak and who gets to tell the story, the sort of the grand narratives at the moment. I mean, they are very apt technologists, but there aren't that many very apt humanists or like whatever pro-social people that are actually getting to speak at that level. So, I mean, when you try to solve the problem of human connectivity through, let's say, Facebook, I mean, then there's a preconditioning there. There's a history there, a personal history or personal sort of skill level of certain things and maybe less skill in other aspects that are going to color how you see the world. And of course, then sort of relationality or relationships is a problem to be solved versus if you listen to someone that has spent their life in. So, I mean, that's what I'm also finding in terms of economics. You know, like when looking at the world through an economic lens, that's a self-referential closed system of explanations that work because they work, because they build on one another. So they're axiomatically logical, like they're coherent, but it's because of certain axioms. And then when you break out of that system and you start looking from other lenses, or when you take in the sciences like anthropology or sociology, and like, I mean, all of the problems that they are associated with as well in terms of their history, but they still have a different relationship to complexity and a different relationship to how people work. And so, I don't know. I heard someone say, Camila Moreno was saying at the conference of local futures a few months back, she was saying that the climate change is a result of the Celsius scale. So it's like, I mean, and she doesn't mean necessarily that it isn't happening. She just means that because we are measuring and what we are measuring and how we're looking at the world, that is the problem. And there are many, many different ways of explaining what's going on right now that might or might not relate to, let's say, a temperature increase or actual heating. There are other ways that we could look at this problem and explain this problem, and that would warrant for very different solutions. So I think what you were saying before, that, you know, Dr. Christian Wald was saying in terms of being guided by the questions, I mean, this is to me absolutely, absolutely crucial. And to dare to be local as well. I mean, there are certain things that need to be global, I'm sure, but also to dare to sort of contextualize things, to let them take ground again, and to, you know, deal with Descartes in that way, maybe not mind-body separation, but rather let's ground ourselves in the earth and in the soil and in the sort of biophysical reality, and not just abstract away so that we can agree on a higher level of something that we don't necessarily really agree on, but you know, when we get into the details.
And I think, I mean, I need, there is a long overdue catch up between Daniel and me that needs to happen. But I think that we need to hold these two spaces together, because there is a need indeed to really sort of relate back to a very direct environment. Yeah. And depending on, I remember Noor saying, for example, that, you know, an environment or an ecology doesn't need to be stewarded. So there are some people who will say, you know, humans need to steward or, you know, safeguard or protect or regenerate. Nor I think, you know, like sheds light on the complexity that has an intelligence in of itself, even without humans, right? But where humans interact with it. But there is a level of extraction, abstraction indeed, that sort of comes with, well, globalization has reached a peak, but it has brought a sense of, it brought people in some ways together, in others no, right? Like it's also plenty of contrast. And but if we have evolved to this notion of planetary security, so we're going to see how economics evolve and, you know, how sort of to create security via economic interdependencies on some things and others not. But there is a need essentially to sort of have a sense of what's at stake here is indeed the future of complex human civilizations and humanity as a whole. Humanity in its spiritual, metaphysical, or sort of, you know, like meta-object type of thing, and also just very concretely how we relate to one another. And here it brings, it almost circles back also to the question that you were asking, who gets to speak? I was recently sort of, you know, like talking with students actually in Stockholm. And because I was talking with students, I was trying to bring just to pepper my talk with a bit more optimism, because a lot of people sort of, you know, like feel quite heavy. And when I try to sort of lay the land when it comes to the energy transition, particularly in policy circles, and I didn't want to do that with students. And so I was essentially sort of talking in terms of like, we still have time, right? Mm-hmm. We still have time to course correct and things like this. And a young Egyptian woman raised her voice, and it was at the moment when the Libyan floods, it was just 2 days after the Libyan floods of this summer happened. And she said, no, we don't. I mean, like saying we still have time, it comes from a place of privilege, comes from a place of protection, comes from a place of safety. People in Libya, people in Egypt don't have time anymore. And it was just of such an ironic kind of, you know, like table turning, because I'm accustomed to saying, no, we don't have time. Yeah. She was the one sort of saying this, and also sort of, you know, like indeed bringing up that sense of like, we need to have a different way to talk to one another. We need to have a different way of relating to one another. And to sort of bring these sort of like this difficulty to give a sort of coherent picture. Right now, everything is moving, right? Natural resources are moving. Time is accelerating and at the same time distending. Space is becoming something where, you know, like it's being contested, it's being competed over. Mm-hmm. It provokes a lot of movements of, you know, humans as a whole in specific geographies first, but, you know, like we're in it all together. And trying to bring all of that in a coherent language at the moment and sort of narrative, holding all of these different dilemmas, which are going to resonate deeply differently for everyone, is a very real challenge. But I think the reality is that, you know, climate change and ecological sort of forms of collapse will bring us to this. And to a certain extent, and that maybe just the weird paradox, and I don't know, right? Like, it's just like these are sort of things that I observe, or, you know, that I sort of, that I question, which are in my intellectual landscape. I, to a certain extent, the systems rivalry, which is at play today between different parts of the world, between economic and sort of, you know, various forms of power, may usher us first towards the zero-sum geopolitical competition, but may, by ushering us towards this, also usher us towards this thing of like, no, we really can't do it without one another. We're going to have to find different modalities of relating to one another, yeah, in terms of how to look at resources, how to look at habitable places, how to look at humanity, how to look at life. And I'm hoping that we will eventually emerge with some kind of coherent narrative across regions, because for the moment I see a lot of divisions across regions rather than a sense of how to move together. And I see that across the board, right? From Europe, from African regions, from Latin American regions, from the US, from China. Like it's just, we're at a time of fragmentation. We're not at a time of sort of like coming together after the fragmentation.
And I think, I mean, in a way it's interesting that it is fragmenting, because I think in a way it's probably what needs to happen, right? I mean, I think a lot of these stories that we've been telling that are very streamlined are the reason why we're here at this moment. So, I mean, maybe the fragmentation is exactly as you're pointing to. I mean, that is the next natural step to take stock of where we are in our, like in my backyard. Like, what does it look like here? Like, what are the consequences that I can accept? And if I can't accept the consequences that are necessary, then maybe I have to cultivate a position internally so that I can accept it. Like, how do I sort of relocalize or deal with my own stuff? Because, I mean, there's so much, you know, changing the others or solving the problem over there ism that is very tricky. And then you don't want to take the consequences, and then other people are taking the consequences for your decisions. And Have you come across Vanessa Andreotti's work, the Hospicing Modernity book? I would recommend it deeply. It's one of the best books that I've, but she's really looking at modernity as a cultural movement and how that is dying. And it's sort of, it relates to the Zizek, I think it's right, the quote that it's easier to understand, to imagine the end of the world than the end of modernity.
She's right.
And also like the Dugelhain is the same thing, is saying like the end of the world as we know it is not the end of the world necessarily. Like that, those types of quotes are what they're pointing to. And we're gonna finish this off right now, I think. And I'm so grateful for having this conversation. I love that we could stay in problem space and just outline these different conflicts, areas of conflicts and aspects of predicament that we're in without necessarily offering solutions. And I think this is wonderful. And to have your view on this is beautiful. So thank you so much. If people want to find you somewhere online, where should they look?
LinkedIn. And I have my Carnegie Europe page where I publish my research. It sort of comes drop by drop, as we say in French. I'm not a very prolific writer. I take a lot of time to sort of think things through and to make sure that I don't imagine the end of the world too much, but I try to sort of like look for something which is, you know, prepare for it. And on there, I think that, you know, my email is actually written on the Carnegie page. So easy.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
It was a really lovely conversation. Thank you for holding that space with me, Amit, and I look forward to the next time.